you've spoken about your relationship with your dad in the past. If he could actually see what you've done here with business, with the charity, podcasting and doing all this stuff, what would you think the conversation would sound like?
I don't know. It would be, well, I do know he'd be saying something to me like, look how far you've come. Look how far you've come. People always associate how far you've come with financials. For me, it's more of a personal journey. I think he would have just been really happy that I'm prepared to get in front of a mic and whatever happens, happens. If I block, I block. If I stumble, I stumble. And the fact that I'm prepared to get in front of a mic would just be the best thing for him to see.
You're listening to the Underdog Way podcast with me, Ruben Pillai, where I interview amazing guests who face adversity, overcome challenges, and found their purpose. We share stories to inspire change. Remember, your change will begin when you turn inspiration into action. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Stop Holding Back Foundation, a charity really close to my heart that is focused on the personal development of people who stutter. A big shout out to everyone part of the SHB family. I love you all and thank you for the support. Every corner twice as bright, there'll be my treasures forever. When I can't hold you tight, I'll see the Stockholm lights. The Stockholm lights, the Stockholm lights. Welcome back to the podcast. Thank you very much, as always, for your feedback and comments. It really helps me develop and grow. Today's guest is CJ, aka Christopher Jackson, one of my good friends who's also a person who stutters. He's a business owner, charity co-founder and director, and has made massive strides overcoming his stuttering and developing over the last few years. CJ's story is a great example to anyone looking to overcome adversity. He speaks very, very openly about his struggles and his challenges, and he's very transparent even now about what he has to do to actually carry on progressing. This was a really, really good interview to record, so much so that we went on for 2 hours. So I've split this into two parts, and this is part one, and part two will be coming out in due course. Thank you again for supporting. Please leave feedback. I'll get back to you as soon as possible. But until then, please enjoy this next episode of the Underdog Way podcast with Christopher Jackson.
CJ, welcome to the Underdog Way podcast. My name is Ruben Pillai, and this is yet another episode. And today I've got someone, I wouldn't say he's special, but he would not agree with me, but he's a good friend of mine. We are friends, colleagues, and really good friends, actually. Happy to be here actually in person speaking to Christopher Jackson, aka CJ. What's good, Chris?
All good, Ruben. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your kind words as well.
Thank you for being on, actually. You know what? I was actually really close to doing the intro to SHB Unfiltered. Shall we just do it just for old time's sake?
You can do it for jokes if you want.
How did it go again? Remember?
This is the SHB Unfiltered podcast, the only podcast that streams live every day.
Taking Q&A on Facebook. We put ourselves on the spot every single day during lockdown, because we are in lockdown. I've had nothing better to do than start a podcast, a chat show. We do this every single day.
Crazy times.
My name is Ruben Pillai, and my co-host, the other part of the podcast, Christopher Jackson, aka CJ. This is episode number what, Chris?
101 now.
101. Well, I just wanted to say that, but it didn't hit me actually at first. However, today I thought this would be a great chance to actually interview you, because you know what? I want people to get to know the real Chris, not just the one with the slick back hair, spending lockdown in Greece. posting wicked stories and posts. I'm killing out there. But yeah, CJ, just to make it easy, I'm going to ask you to simply say a few things about yourself, and then I'm going to start probing you and asking you a bunch of questions.
No problem. My name's CJ. I currently run a recruitment company with my sister, my business partners, been running it for 3 years. I'm just a normal guy. I have a few hobbies and a few interests, basketball being one of them, football being another one. Ruben doesn't agree with me supporting Tottenham, but I do support Tottenham. And I like to think now I live a pretty simple life. I focus on my business, focus on growing that, and really excited about my charity work as well with you, Ruben. And that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. Business, charity, hobbies, normal guy.
Chris, that's probably the most humble introduction I've heard in some time, because we both know that you do a lot more than it sounds. And I think we should really take it back a bit, because I wanted to actually talk to you about the first time I met you.
Yep.
Do you remember that evening?
I remember that evening very clear.
But do you remember the conversation we had and the situation in which we met each other for the first time? Because I think we've spoken a few times before that via man like Ayo Adesanya.
Yep. Yeah. I remember the very first conversation we had when you were helping me on my ST sounds and you were giving me speech exercises to work on.
Yeah.
That was the very first conversation we had, but that was over the phone. Steve, style, stow, style, stew, and all that kind of stuff.
That stuff works, man. That stuff works.
It definitely worked. The first time we met in person, though, was on a speech course where I was just about to give a very difficult speech in front of a lot of, quite a hostile crowd.
I wouldn't say hostile, but we actually met before that.
Outside.
No, yeah, as in, so we met properly through Simon on that day. Just to add some context, yes, it was the Maguire program. This was back in March 2018. And I was actually responsible for that Harrison workshop, which is for people listening. I was coordinating like a type of speaking workshop with a lot of acting and like different focus on different types of public speaking facets. Yes. For quite a lot of people. I think in the end we had about 100 to 120 people taking part in that workshop.
Yeah, there was a lot of people.
Which was the biggest I've ever seen. And so I was in charge of organizing that and assigning roles to different people.
Yes.
And so traditionally, roles were assigned to people who were returning onto courses. Maybe it was the first time back or the second time back. So I had the idea of, hey, like, let's give Chris a role. So make him kind of the leader of one of these focus groups. So I walked up and said, hey, Chris, fancy being a Harrison group leader for the day. It's pretty simple. You just need to focus on this and explain it, and that's it really. Do you remember your reaction?
Yeah, I was like, no, man.
Now, as in, you were completely speechless. I was thinking, what has happened? And then you were just looking at me with like you just seen a ghost.
Yeah.
And then Simon kind of interjected and said, oh, Ruben, just like break it down and explain to him what he has to do. Yeah. And keep it simple, because remember, like, this is first time back in years and years. And I was like, all right, cool. Sorry, I forgot. Then I explained it again. And then he also added to that explanation. Yeah. I think he did it in the end, right? I can't remember.
Yeah. He just explained that, you know, you're going to get told what to do. You're going to have to explain it. The groups are going to change. They're going to rotate. So there'll be, you'll stick at one station, I believe, if I remember correctly. And then groups rotate and you give them a certain part of the Harrison workshop when they get to your station. And yeah, I was really nervous, man. I was really nervous. I just thought a leadership role already. I'm just getting back into this.
Wasn't this like your second or third day in? Or it was probably your first day I came up to.
No, it's probably the first day.
Yeah, I probably asked you really early on to get you prepared.
Yeah. And I was like, this is the first kind of public speaking situation I've been in really for years. Probably one of the only ones I'd ever been involved in, really. And I just thought, this is too much for me. How am I going to do it? And you wasn't taking no for an answer, to put it simply. You were like, what are you here for? You're here to work on your speech. You're here to work on yourself. What are you going to do? You were basically saying to me in a nice way, are you going to punk out or not? That's basically what you said to me. And I was like, I can't punk out. That's why I'm here. That's what I'm here to do. I'm here to improve myself and improve my speech. But it was a big jump for me personally. When you watch it and you watch others in there that have been and they're returning on courses, they don't really seem too fazed by it. But because I had never been on a course, well, I had been on a course, but not at that age, yeah.
So your first one was when you were 13?
Yeah, child, yeah. I was a kid.
Completely different.
Yeah, there was no leading groups then. It was just, you line up, people switch, they explain a part of the course to you, you recite it, maybe you go for contacts. And that was about it, really. That's what I can remember of it. This Harrison workshop for me was brand new. And yeah, it was a challenge, but we took it on, Ruben. We done it. I think I done a good job anyway at the time.
Like, what was your experience of actually kind of taking the lead then on the actual day? So, because of the rotation, so I think you spend around 15 minutes per group, and there must have been about 6 groups. What was your development within that kind of period, that 1.5 hours?
It was quite big, to be honest. It was a big, from the first group that came to the last group, it's just like worlds apart. The way you approach the last group with completely different persona, completely different attitude, the way you deliver it, your voice projection is completely different. The first one, you're nervous. Okay, this is what you've got to do. I can't even remember what station I had though, what my topic was, or I can't remember. But you say it with zero authority. You hope that people get involved. You hope that people take on the challenge. But by the end, you're becoming the one that's encouraging everyone to get involved and to do it and to not hold back and to push themselves. And afterwards, you take a step back and you think, was that actually me at the end? Is that what I've become? And it was quite a big experience for me, to be fair.
Did you take any of that into kind of your working life or afterwards? So when you return back home, back to your friends and family again, and getting back into work and stuff, did you kind of take any of the lessons learned? Because I reckon kind of being within that group for a couple of days, really like positive, like people working on their speech, etc., in general, and just trying to improve, did you feel like, okay, so I've gained something here, and I proved to myself that, look, I can actually speak quite confidently in public. Did you feel that there was a natural transition back into your actual working life?
No, not a direct transition, simply because I was fully aware that it was a safe environment. I was fully aware that other people were there to work on their speech. Other people were aware of why I was there, who I am, what I struggle with. So it wasn't a direct transition, but it did give me belief that you do have the ability to speak. You do have the ability to get your words out in front of a group of people. And there's no reason why you can't do that in challenging environments as well. You just need to figure out how to get your mind in check so that you can do it. And you're not just stopping yourself from doing it because there's a mental block. That's what it taught me. That there is a way. You need to find the way to transition that into that. But just because you've been able to do it on that course didn't give me 100% confidence that I can go and do it at work. The first time we had a group meeting at work, I still had a little bit of tension. I still was working on my speech in the right way. But because leading up to that course, my speech journey was different to most. Most people would go there and that would be their first experience with any technique, any introduction to the stuttering community. But for me, because I was working on my speech at work anyway, prior to that, I'd already experienced a little bit of discomfort at work using the technique, or, you know, working on your speech in a real world environment. I already knew that it could be challenging, whereas other people may attend the course and they think, wow, this is amazing. I'm going to leave here and I'm going to be fine. I already knew that that's not the case. So I was already aware of it, but it did improve me. It did grow me. And I knew after that, that I would be able to perform, if you want to call it that, in the real world at some point. I just need to work out how.
Cool. So you are a business owner alongside your sister, and you are also charity co-founder as well. And you brought me into the charity with AO. From the end of that course to the whole inception of SA Speak, quite a bit happened in that period. I remember a couple of stories that you told me of a worthwhile and interesting trip to Greece.
Yep.
Have you got any highlights from that trip, and maybe some of the things that actually led to the kind of like genesis of SHB and how it started to actually form from the building blocks?
Yeah. I'll start with the highlight. The highlight for me was just being able to speak on my terms to people in Greece, because at 17 or 18 years old, I lived in Greece for 1 year, and speech-wise, it was a dreadful year for me.
Playing basketball, right?
Playing basketball, yeah. But speech-wise, in everyday life, just out there, was a nightmare for me. And it was really nice to be able to go there again and have a different mindset, a different attitude towards myself, how I spoke. My belief system was completely different. And for me to be out there and have the opportunity to cancel it out, that for me was a highlight for the whole thing. That I enjoyed the whole trip mainly because of that, because I felt like, well, I'm in the same place, but I'm a different person. But the reason why we were there was we were attending a Maguire program. And we already planned to go to the course, but we had a ticket for 10 days, I think. So the course is, 2 days? So we knew we were going to be there for a week.
Vacation as well.
Extra. Like, yeah.
Do quite a few other things because, yeah, you're going to fly out there. But
yeah,
once you're there, you might as well turn it into a trip as well.
Yeah. But the plan was for me, AO, and Simon to really just live life in another country, working on our speech outside of a course environment. So, you know, we're genuinely on holiday, we're at restaurants, we're at beaches, we're renting cars, we're ordering food, where me and AO went to a club a couple times, you know, so you're ordering drinks at the bar, all these real life situations that as a stutterer, you dread them. You never want to be in that position on your own. You always look to be with fluent people. You always look for them to get you out of trouble. So it was just an opportunity for us to be away enjoying ourselves. And whilst we were there, we were realizing what AO and Simon had done for my speech journey and how that's not taught on any other program. That strategy is not discussed. It's not taught at all.
Why do you think that is? Because if that was what was working for you, why do you think that that isn't a norm on any other speech program, course, or kind of therapy?
I just think they don't have the capacity to be able to do it. That's what I personally believe, and I don't blame them for that. That's not their strategy. That's not how they've set up their organization. They haven't built it to be able to deliver it the way it was delivered to me. And that was by coming into my workplace, coaching me in my real world environment, focusing on what I wanted to do, what my motivation was, what challenges I wanted to overcome, and focusing on that, zoning in on that. And when you get success in that, it changes everything.
Do you think there was like kind of anything in particular that actually led to you having that experience? Because that's not something I've heard of before for people to do that. So do you think it was something that you maybe demonstrated, or do you think it was just like pure luck that you first spoke to Simon, and then he put you in touch with AO, who happened to live not too far away from you? Do you think all those things were just like dominoes falling into place and at the right time?
I think it was pure luck that I got in contact with Simon Bailey the way that happened. I think that was pure luck, because I know people that have done exactly the same thing as me, and it's a different experience for them, and they haven't been successful, and they wasn't happy with how their speech journey turned out. So it is luck. A lot of these speech courses, as you know, it's not about what is taught necessarily. I believe any program out there can help you to make improvements with your speech. I do genuinely believe that. But it's whether the people there, it's whether you connect with those individuals, it's whether you trust them, it's whether you like how they deliver it, or you like their attitude, or you just like how they present things to you. And I was very lucky that the night that I decided to get back in contact was a night that the person that I contacted was in a WhatsApp group with Simon Bailey, and Simon Bailey said, tell the guy to call me. And that was really lucky, because there's no one else that I know of that has been prepared to help people the way that I was helped. There's no one out there. I mean, do you know anyone that's prepared to drop everything that they're doing, come to your workplace and sit with you for 4, 5, 6 hours at a time sometimes to coach you through work calls? I don't know anyone that's prepared to do that.
For free as well, right?
Completely for free.
Free as well.
Completely voluntary. Yeah, I was very lucky. I was very lucky. But what I would say is, AO and Simon knew that they wasn't wasting their time on me.
I was just about to say that, actually.
Yeah, they knew straight away they wasn't wasting their time. They knew how much I wanted it. They knew I was prepared to try anything. I was prepared to listen to them. I trusted them. Anything they asked me to do, I was just prepared to do it and take on the challenge. And I think maybe one reason why other people are not, they don't get the same treatment as what I got, is because people can see that they're not really putting their all into it. They're not really trying it. They're not committing. Yeah, they want it, but they're not prepared to put in the work that you really need to put in to make progress. And with me, it was everything. I was obsessed. I wasn't just trying to make a few improvements on my speech. I was obsessed. I was making 100 phone calls in the morning. I was walking to the shop just to ask for things in the shop, even though I walk in that same shop every day. I was making like 5 to 10 contacts in every single shop. I was like a madman, obsessed. If I blocked on a word at work, I would be going outside to find a word that started with the same letter, and I was smashing these contacts out constantly. And when people can see how much work you're putting in, they know they're not wasting their time. So I think I was very lucky, but they also knew how much work I was prepared to put in, so they were prepared to match it. So
what was your kind of like family environment like as well? Because taking this step and putting in all that time and really making changes into how you're actually behaving, did they like fully support it? Did they see positives and encourage you in the right way? Like, what was the vibe like with your family?
The vibe was the right vibe, but only because they were educated on what I was doing. Mm-hmm. They, as part of what I was working on, what I had to do is I had to bring them in on it. that was part of the little course that Simon and AO created together. And they needed to be up to speed with what I was working on, so that when I was with them and I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do, they knew and they were aware of what I was supposed to be doing. So there was no room for me to start slacking or getting away with it, because they would know. They wouldn't be putting the blame on the call saying, oh, maybe what you're doing is not right, or maybe it's not working because your speech is still bad. It was like, okay, well, you might be blocking, but I know you're supposed to be breathing. I know you're supposed to be using this technique. I know you're supposed to be cancelling things out that are not right. I know you're supposed to be keeping eye contact with me and you're not. These things they were fully aware of, and they were able to support me on that. So when I got frustrated, they were able to coach me through it, and they weren't getting frustrated at me getting frustrated because they knew what the issues were. Whereas when people are working on something and no one around them knows what they're supposed to be doing, they can't support them. They just have to sit back and watch, and they feel helpless if it's not working. But and then the person feels guilty. The person working on their speech feels guilty because they're trying to show their family around them how much improvement they've made, and the family can't really see it. And then it's just like, it's a really... I've experienced it before. It's a negative experience. Because you've got to remember, when I was a kid and my parents had paid all this money to a course, and I'm going home and I'm still stuttering out of control, and they can't understand, well, what was you doing? I've just paid all this money. What did you learn? Did you learn anything?
Come on, Chris.
Yeah, like,
speak, bro.
What's going on?
Yeah.
So when people around you are educated on it and they know what's going on, they know that the issue is you. When it is you, and they know the issue is not you when it's not you. So it's really, for me, I think it's vital that the people you spend the most time with are in on what you're doing, and they understand what you're doing, because then they push you. When you're at a restaurant, they're not ordering, they're not talking for you.
That's good.
You know?
Because then you bring them on in the journey with you, isn't it? Because I guess they've been with you since stuttering started. So it makes sense to actually bring them along, because they will... also, I guess, feel happy if you're progressing, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as a parent, you can only imagine how happy it makes them to see you make massive improvements and do things that you never thought you could do. And from, like, my sister, who I work with, Stephanie, Charlie, my girlfriend, they've seen me really frustrated about it. They've seen me give up on everything. They've seen me not want to even get out of bed in the morning because of it. So for them, it was nice. And for them to encourage me, and for them to see me do good things or have success in my speech, or to go out for lunch and I'm ordering the food, for them, it's just a great, great feeling for them.
That's really good, man. That's really sweet. It's good to hear. There's something you said about it was just by luck that you managed to, as in, you called Simon at that time and he put you in touch with AO. But you did say that like sometime before when we were talking, that your trigger was actually watching School for Stammerers documentary.
Not my trigger. The trigger was Stephanie and Charlie's trigger. Since they watched that program, they were driving me mad.
Did you watch it as well, by any chance?
I watched it.
Yeah.
I did watch it after they drove me mad too. I refused to watch it at the beginning because I was like, listen.
We were in it, bro.
Yeah.
In the background somewhere.
I know.
How dare you?
And now I refused to watch it because I had the attitude that this hasn't worked for me before. I've tried it. It hasn't worked. I'm not going to try it again. And speech was getting really bad for me, man. So I knew I had to do something. I just didn't know what it was. And I was in such a state where I wasn't really talking at all. I wasn't really speaking much in social situations, in anywhere, restaurants, just at home. I wasn't really having many conversations, so I knew I had to do something about it.
Like, how would you actually describe, like, speech getting really bad? what does that actually mean to you personally? What does it vividly sound like or look like?
Waking up in the morning and it's the first thing on your mind. Going to bed at night and it's the last thing you think of. Waking up in the morning with chest pains from anxiety. And knowing that no matter what kind of challenge you take on today, you got to do it all over again tomorrow. No matter what fear you face today, no matter how much you achieve, it's never going to end there. You've got to do it all over again tomorrow. And it's just constant worry about how everyone thinks of you, constant worry of people's judgment, looking stupid, looking like you're incompetent, feeling lucky to be in the situation that you are in, whatever that may be, in terms of work, in terms of you don't feel like you really deserve what you have because people have had to ask for it for you or you've had to get it through another means. You couldn't just go and do it yourself. Just pure avoidance. That's what it means to me. Just avoiding everything, hiding away.
And if you didn't like take any action at that point, like where did you see this ending up? Because you made that phone call when you were 28 years old, coming up to the big 30. Where did you see this heading?
I saw this heading in a situation where my sister got really frustrated with me at work, where Stephanie felt like she was doing all the work and I wasn't contributing much. A feeling for me of being given a handout, which I knew wasn't the case when we launched, but I was worried it could develop into it. As the business grows, if I'm hiding away still and we're growing and we're employing more people and there's generally nothing for me to do, what's my role here? If I haven't got a leadership role at all, if I'm not talking to the staff, if I'm not talking to banks or clients or to anyone, what's my role here really? So my main fear was that Stephanie would get frustrated with me because I had a previous business where that happened with a friend. I know working with family is different to friends, but I still know family members that have fallen out of a business and stuff like that. And I knew that me not pulling my weight could make us reach that point. So there was no way that I was going to allow my speech to affect the business, to affect mine and Steph's relationship. And that was the real motivation that I knew the only thing that could stop the business from working at that point was me, because I knew that Steph had the skills. I knew that I had the skills. I just knew that it was a good possibility that I wasn't going to allow myself to show the skills I had simply because my stutter would make me avoid.
So when you actually embarked on the business, like, were these things going through your mind at that time? Because for people who stutter traditionally, even things like kind of approaching a job interview is a madness, and then presenting, but then starting something for yourself, which means putting yourself on the spot every single day, that must be a nightmare scenario. Did that go through your mind at the time when you first decided to go into business with your sister?
When we launched the business, no, because I was only thinking short term. I was only thinking, let's launch a business that we feel we can make a success and let's see where it goes. But as we were beginning to make the business a success, by the time I contacted Simon, we were 1 year into the business. So I could see where it was heading. And I could see that there was times where I needed to be a bit more prominent, a bit more involved. I needed to stop making my lists and telling Steph to make the phone calls. And I needed to just pick up the phone and sort it out straight away, because it was delaying things, because we were getting busier and busier and busier. And if Steph's client facing and there's an issue with finances or there's an issue with someone's payroll or anything like that, and I'm waiting for Steph to call someone to sort it out, then a job that should take me 2 minutes might not get finished until the end of the day when Steph can make that phone call. So it was just becoming a bit ridiculous. And I was like, okay, your sister knows that you've got a stutter and your sister's patient with you, but in terms of how the business is functioning, it's wrong. It's not right. It like simply doesn't make any sense. So I knew that I needed to step it up. I knew I needed to own my area. So that was the motivation.
You can actually take a look at Instagram and see like quite a lot of people talking about having a venture or business or setting something up, and it looks really glamorous on social media and stuff. And there's actually like a stigma against people who are employees in a weird way, especially if you work in the corporate sector. But is owning and running your own business as glamorous as it looks on social media, or and especially as someone with a speech impediment for so long and actually launched when it wasn't in a good place, and when your mental health as well was probably in a weak place as well? Is it as glamorous as it looks on social media?
No. Nowhere near. Because what you're seeing on social media is once the person's made it. But there's 1,000 people that have launched a business that haven't made it. So you're only seeing the 1% or the 10%, whatever the figure is. You're only seeing that. When you launch a business, what you've got to realize is everything is on you. Anything that goes wrong, there's no one for you to blame. You're in charge. The directors of the company are in charge. You're responsible. So there's nowhere to hide. Like, you know, if you're working in the corporate world and you're working on a project and there's a few people on the project, you can say, okay, well, I've done my part. He didn't do his part, or something like that. Or you can blame anything. You can blame like, oh, I wasn't supported from the people above me or this or whatever it is. But when you're the owner of the company, you know what you're getting yourself into. You know it's on you. So you can't just start blaming other people or blaming external factors or this variable or that or that. It's on you. You have to figure it out. And when you start employing people, I mean, for me, Gary Vee put it the best way. Because what people do not realize, and what I did realize early on, is when you hire someone, you think they're working for you, but you're actually working for them. You know, you're actually, at the end of the month, if your company hasn't made enough money, that person still needs to be paid. So you're responsible for that. Yeah. You know, so it is glamorous if you smash it and you get that lifestyle that comes with what everyone wants or what they think you get when you're an entrepreneur. But being an entrepreneur is not a fashion statement. It's not something that you can just take on and just have or just decide you want to do. For me personally, I believe it's got to be in you. You can't just decide next week, oh, do you know what? I've seen that Instagram post. Entrepreneurship looks quite sick. I'm going to try it out. Yeah, try it out. And when things are not going to plan and the stress is on you and the pressure's on you, you got to realize there isn't a paycheck coming for you at the end of the month if you haven't created nothing, if you haven't worked your socks off, if you haven't created something out of nothing. There's no paycheck coming for you. So you have to make that happen yourself, and you've got to motivate a team. You've got to pull different strings. And at the beginning, you have to wear different hats that potentially you're not very good at. So you've got to find a way to be good at it. Like for me, I knew I wasn't good at talking. I was never good at talking. So I knew that I had to get someone to talk for me. Yeah, I might dictate word for word what they say in a meeting or over the phone, but I had to get someone to do that. So I knew that I had to build a team. And at the beginning, when you're trying to hire people and you've got something holding you back and you feel like your employees do not respect you and all these different things that are going on in your mind and you're still trying to run a business at the same time, it can be very tough. It can be very, very tough. Financial pressures, there's so many pressures that are only relieved once you hit a certain mark. And me and Steph are not even at that mark yet, and we're 3 years in. So it's definitely not as glamorous as everyone makes out, especially at the start as well.
Back in the past, when you were studying at university, you were kind of like wanting to try to get into a job in finance.
Yep.
In like the corporate type sector. And I think as well in that period as well for me, that was the general vibe. People were vying for that type of career. But I can see now there's a bit more people looking at more entrepreneurial opportunities, trying to be self-starters instead of working for someone. But for you, you kind of went and looked at that route, but then went down the entrepreneurial route instead. Do you kind of like see that decision as justified at the moment because of that culture shift, and you had already entered that type of environment with starting a business with your friend first and then your sister now? Do you think that, I know, I just want to say, do you feel like you're kind of a trendsetter in that sense?
No, I don't think I'm a trendsetter, but what I would say is my reason for wanting to go into a finance background was because I grew up in an area where there was a lot of peer pressure from like the people that live there. It's very competitive. My son's doing this, my son's doing that, what's your son gonna do? My son's in finance, my son works for this bank or that bank. And it was very much like that. So it made me think that that was the route. You know, everyone's trying to get into it, they can't all be wrong, so I need to get into that route, you know. And I knew that my speech, I wasn't able to go into an interview and talk to the person interviewing me to his blue in the face and sell myself. I knew I was never going to be able to convince him that I'm the best thing since sliced bread. I know people that weren't the best thing since sliced bread, but they were able to do that. They were able to do that. And I knew I was never going to be able to do that. And the reason why I got into starting my own business is because I knew no one's going to give me a job because I can't interview. So I need to make something happen somehow. I can't just have no money forever. I need to make something happen somehow. And that's the reason why I explored that route. That's the reason why I explored that route. But I knew that, okay, you can't get a job because you can't interview. But then you can't run a business because you can't speak for yourself. So you're going to have to get someone to talk for you. And initially, that's why I always wanted a business partner. Because I thought, if you can't do something, you need to get someone that can. And that was my attitude. So that's why the first business was with my friend. He was great at client facing, brilliant at client facing, but clueless when it came to anything business related or setting up a company or invoicing, you know, pretty simple business stuff. But he just weren't interested in it. He just loved to talk to people and network, and we made a great team. It only fell apart when people started getting in his ear saying, okay, but CJ don't really bring in any work. CJ just like does your books, or he just invoices, or he just does this and that. You know, you can get anyone to do that. But what they wasn't aware of is that, yeah, he can go into the meeting, but who's telling him what to say in the meeting? Who's telling him what to come back with when those people are coming back at him or trying to challenge him or trying to negotiate? People don't see that. But when someone's in your ear, you can't even realize that. And then your head starts growing and you start to think, okay, I'm giving CJ half of everything that I earn. And then when you get that attitude in as a partnership, it's pretty much dead from there. You can't really recover from that. So entrepreneurship, you know, I don't like to call it that because I think like, I don't really like people who label themselves entrepreneurs. I think it's something that people call you. You just want to start a business. Mm-hmm. You know, so starting a business was just something that I knew I had to do if I wanted to earn money because I wasn't going to get a job. Simple, really.
As your speech started to progress and you became a lot more confident, I'm actually going to say that word again, entrepreneurship, but you took that entrepreneurial spirit with AO and looked at the charity path. But how did it actually get to that point from Greece? Greece was one of your big, I say turning points, but you probably had a few at that point, but that may have been one of the bigger ones in that period, if I'm not mistaken. A few other kind of conversations and things led to the actual idea of starting a charity, which is now called SHB. Take us back on a trip down memory lane, Chris.
Yeah. In Greece, we were realizing that we were doing things completely different. Not completely different, but we were doing different things other than just physical techniques that were really benefiting us, that we were really implementing into everyday life. And
by physical techniques, you mean like just like breathing exercises? Or
yeah, breathing.
Like modifications of sounds and that kind of stuff.
You know, speech fluency, modernization techniques, whatever you want to call them. We were doing other things and we were working on our speeches a bit differently. And, the fundamentals were pretty similar, but there were suggestions that we would be making that would be getting dismissed. And we were like, no, this is important. We've been trying this for 3-4 months and we've been making massive progress. And we realized that our views were not the same as what we were currently told to do. So we knew that we wanted to do things a bit differently. AO had the WhatsApp group. He started the WhatsApp group.
Road to Self-Actualization.
Yeah, the Road to Self-Actualization group.
I remember that group.
And we were getting a lot of people in there from the course we were on. And
so that group started, I think, September 2017.
Yeah.
So that's coming up to 3 years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah. So that was before AO met me.
Yeah.
And in there, AO added me and we're talking to people, and then all of a sudden we're coaching people on the side, and you know, where people are making progress, and
it became a bit of a melting pot, isn't it? Because from what I saw, people from like different areas of the stuttering community all converging into this one place and actually being pretty transparent with each other for the first time.
Yeah, and the issue were pretty much the same. I can use my techniques in the stuttering community, can't use them when it matters to me. I can do it here, but I can't do it here. We kept hearing the same thing over and over and over again, and I was like, "Ayo, you know why, innit? Because they can't allow themselves to believe that they can make progress in the real world because they're not working on their speech in the real world. They're not challenging themselves in the real world. They're always working on their speech in a safe environment. We need to tell them how I was helped. We need to offer that route to these people because that's what I genuinely believe they're missing."
But do you think it's as simple as that? Because when you explain it in that way, for me, it's like, oh, okay then. So I'm going to go and start practicing in like the real world now. But what's actually preventing people from making their strides in the progression in their speech?
What's preventing them from using what they know they should be using is the constant fear of judgment of the other person that they're talking to. And if you're not working on that, if you're not told how to use technique to work on that, you're never going to make progress. You're always just going to be comfortable to use your speech techniques in a safe environment. And that's what the common theme was in this Road to Self-Actualization group. That's what the common discussion was. And you see it. You get people that are going back to courses for years. People on courses for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, they've been to every course and they're still not getting what they want out of it. And I truly believe because they're not shown how to desensitize themselves to people's reactions, to live life on their terms, they just feel like my technique's not working for me, so the technique don't work. And that's their experience. So that's what they believe. But until you show them another way to experience it in a different way, they're always going to believe the same thing. So that's why I was adamant to AO. I was like, we need to find a way to offer this to people. Otherwise, people are just going to be living the same life. And it's, we've all been there. We all know what it's like. And it's just not a nice place to be in. And if I've found a way to help people still use their technique and work on the mindset at the same time through getting the help from Simon and AO, I just see it as almost a responsibility to offer it to the stuttering community. If they want to use it, they can use it. If they don't want to use it, they don't have to use it. But I just feel a responsibility. AO felt a responsibility. You knew what we were working on. I know you feel that responsibility to offer it to the stuttering community.
That was kind of summer 2018. At that point, what was the vision? So where did you actually see this actually heading? And what did it look like to you? Like, how did you envisage helping people? Would it be masses or like small groups, or similar to the experience that you received from Simon and AO? Did you feel it would be some, I'd say, like, what's that term for like a small operation, like a bootstrap type, helping a few people at a time, that kind of thing?
The idea originally was to just help people locally in London that we could travel to, help them at work. Well, we did help someone pretty much straight away. Went to his workplace, spoke to his colleagues. He was making great progress. And then before we knew it, people were just contacting us from everywhere. And we were like, we have to help him. We can't just turn these people away. We have to find a way to help him. And that's where the charity vision came from, just to create the charity so that we can help people. The vision was always online. The vision was always to find a way to help people online. We would have people in London. We would meet up with them face to face, help people further away online. And then coronavirus just made sure that we were definitely online. Yeah. So that was always the vision.
Very, very, I guess, very fortunate again, Chris, because in, I guess, a strange twist of fate, we were already heading down that path, but with the pandemic and us being forced to stay inside, and I guess the normalization of video conferencing, it's been perfect, isn't it? Because
yeah.
It's helped us connect with like people all over the world who stutter as well. One line I remember AO saying to me, I think you were there, I can't remember exactly, but I think this was like part of the reason why the charity idea came about. But he just said he's tired of being like the Maguire program cleanup crew. And it is a bit of a shame, because like we did like learn quite a lot from that program and make huge strides, but there were flaws that like we saw, and we felt that we could actually help people more effectively if we were allowed to actually make these small tweaks and stuff. Because for me personally, I remember on a coaching call with a girl, I can't say her name actually, I really shouldn't, but she was applying for medicine at, I think, 2018. We spoke 2 or 3 times that week before two of her interviews, so she didn't pass two already. So we went through strategy on the first one, then I did some research, got some mock questions on the second one, then I think third one we just did like a final thing, and then She passed the next two, so she got into medicine. She is saving people from COVID-19 right now, probably. That breakthrough for me, from a coaching perspective, it gave me the confidence that, okay, so what I'm doing, it has some value, because helping someone get into, like, get their foot into that type of career is massive, because that's actually life-changing. I don't actually believe that helping people become a bit more fluent or a bit more control in the speech, or whatever you want to call it, is as life-changing as getting them into a certain job or employment or course that is actually a game changer like that. So that's when I realized, hang on a minute, like, there's some value here. And if I totaled up the amount of time I spent for interview prep and then the actual conversation and stuff, I was thinking, okay, so there's a fair bit of time here. That's when the opportunity to, like, jump on the SHB train,
yeah, to be honest,
came along. It's perfect.
To be honest, I was shocked. If I'm honest, because you were such an instrumental part of the coaching team that I had when I was on that program, and I know how they held you in such high regard as a coach. I was surprised that that you were like, listen, I'm in full support of you, I understand what you're doing, I'm involved. I was like, man, that's mad. Because we had people who were genuine friends of ours who turned their back on us just because we were no longer part of that program. Genuine, like, people who, you know, we became quite close with, AO as well, who, like, they won't speak to us no more.
But just getting back to that point, actually. So, thank you very much. My head is a lot bigger than it was 10 seconds ago. But, like, on a personal level, I did feel that I was actually contributing positively. But I didn't feel myself to be some kind of, like, what's that term that Jose Mourinho used for his... his undroppables or untouchables. He had that group of players that would just play every game regardless.
Can't remember, the undroppables, yeah.
Something like that. I always felt that, yeah, like, if a program is that big, they'll find a way. They will replace you with someone else. So it isn't like a massive loss for them. So I could actually create a lot more impact working in a smaller operation, and that's a bit more focused on the actual skills that I brought to the table from my experiences in London's financial sector and going through like loads and loads of interviews and all that kind of stuff, as opposed to just purely like breathing technique and that side of things. So that's what interested me a lot, because that's more like tapping into skills and interests I had. But like you said, people stop talking to you, which is obviously a bit sad, but that's what happens sometimes, isn't it? When like you kind of leave.
Yeah, it is. For me, I was never a coach on the program. So for me, I was coaching alongside AO. And I was learning from my own experience. Because of the experience I had, I knew what worked and what didn't work, because me and AO were working out together. So we were creating a coaching program and using me as a guinea pig almost. So that's what was gearing me up to be able to relay that information onto other people. Then when I was actually finding myself coaching other people without even meaning to or even planning to, and those people were like, you know what, you're going to make a fantastic coach, you're going to be brilliant, you're going to help a lot of people, I was like, okay.
How did that feel? Really gone.
I was like, okay, but I'm coaching you things that are not allowed to be coached here. I'm telling you things that are completely different to what you're hearing. So I don't want to confuse you. I want to coach you. You know, I want you to make progress. I don't want you to be talking to me and then having to ask a million more questions. And then the main aim of the whole charity is to help people with their employability skills, because I know what it's like to have a stutter and feel like you cannot get a job and you do not know how you're going to make a penny. And the person that couldn't get an interview with a recruiter now owns a recruitment company and is managing to own the area of that recruitment company and fully contribute and commit. I want other people to be able to be in that position. If they want to go up the route where they run their own business, then I want them to be able to do that and have the confidence to be able to do that. If they want to get a job in the corporate world or in the IT world or in any world they want to get a job in, I want them to be able to do that, what they genuinely want to do, not what they think they have to settle for. That's the key for me. And I just knew that the way I was being coached by Simon and Ayo was allowing me to get to that point.